Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, what's up, New York City? This is Amy Wilson. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI studios. We are a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 56,000 members nationwide. NYCDSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. I'm an organizer with the DSA of North Brooklyn, and I use she, her pronouns. For today's episode, let's take a trip to the museum. Museums are cultural spaces, but they are also key sites of struggle and centers of industry here in New York City. Right now, our fellow organizers are active in the museum community, participating in union drives and contract struggles, addressing questions of accountability and accessibility, and working to create museum spaces rooted in ethics, equity, and worker power. I'll be speaking to Megan Elevato and Antonio Serna on their work to create a museum workers' manifesto, and of course, about how you can get involved, whether you are a museum visitor, an educator, a parent, or perhaps a museum worker yourself. But first, let's take a moment to check in with another ongoing struggle for worker power, the general strike in France. Here live in the WBAI studios today from France, we have Jean-Pierre Page. He's a former head of the International Department of CGT and a current member of its National Executive Committee. And to speak with Jean-Pierre about what's going on in France, I have my very good comrade and fellow RPM host, Jack Devine.
Well, thank you so much, Jean-Pierre, for joining us today on RPM. And if people are not aware, there's a general strike happening in France. So can you just elaborate on the current situation in France? How did this ongoing general strike emerge? Who is involved in this struggle, and what are their demands?
Now, what's happening in France, it's quite, I would say, historical. It has been a long process for the past years, with many social struggles in France, involving a lot of people, especially, as you have heard, probably the Yellow Jacket. And this has created conditions of strong mobilization. And the president of France, Macron, have decided, and he considers that is one of the most important dimension of his program, to implement a total reform, which in fact is a destruction of our social model in France. Probably, you know, the social model in France is quite unique, and it's probably one of the best in the world, and because it is based on solidarity and not individuality. And because we all participate to the finance of the pension, for example, which is right now the main problem. So he wants to get rid of this and give the whole system to private companies, pension funds, especially an American one, BlackRock, which is very involved in that reform. So there has been a strong mobilization of the people because everybody feel concerned. Everybody understands that he will have to wait until he could get his pension. So work longer and for less. Okay? So now we have millions of people involved. Since December 5, we have a large number of workers involved in a strike, and every day they decide to go on. They're in General Assembly of the workers. They decide to continue, and there is a great determination, and the one involved goes from public to private sectors. Goes from the railway workers to the all our ports in France, for example, are blocked. The electrical workers also are involved. Teachers, hospitals, you said, but it goes up to even lawyers, doctors, even the Paris Ballet is involved, as well as our Philharmonic Orchestra. So I would say that large sectors of the French populations are involved, and that explains why, after 2 months, country is practically blocked. after 2 months, 65% of the whole French population support the strike.
That, I mean, it's so impressive seeing the solidarity of the French working class coming together and fighting to preserve the social system that has, you know, created a really solid base in society, something that is completely absent here in the United States and something that we would need to fight for. So considering, you know, all the sectors of the working class that are coming together, and we do have to get to our next interview soon, so please keep this brief if you can, but is there a revolutionary situation? Is this a revolutionary moment in France? And how does it connect to the other uprisings against capital all across the globe?
So I would say, first of all, that you know, France is very well known for revolutions because we had quite a lot already. And as you know, probably Marx used to say that France is the country where the revolutions and class struggles goes up to the end. So it is true that by some ways, yes, we can say yes, it's a revolutionary situation. Why? Because we have started with a social problem, a social issue, which was the pension. And everybody understands that behind this affair of pensions is a choice of society. You see, our society, our social model in France is based on solidarity. What Macron wants to do is to get rid of this system to give it to the marchandization, you know, the finance, the big finance, you know, institutions like BlackRock, which is twice the GDP of France. So for the people understand that. So now we have come to a social issue up to a political issue. Everybody understands that in front of us, we have a resistance. Okay? And if we want to get rid of that resistance and to succeed in our battle, we have to find political answers. And we usually speak a lot everywhere about consequences of the capitalist crisis. Okay? But we have to make the people understand that what we have to confront are the cause of that situation. And the cause is the system itself. And that system has come to a point that it is totally unable to answer to the fundamental demands of peoples, of humanity, all the big challenges that we are facing today, whether it is social justice, environment, democracy, etc. So everybody can understand that. So now we have to work on the political issues.
I think that is a perfect way to frame it. And thank you so much for joining us here on Revolutions Per Minute. We stand in solidarity with the struggling workers in France. And we hope to continue to update our listeners on the ongoing fight there. So thank you so much again for coming
on. Thank you very much. Bye.
Yes, merci beaucoup. All right. So now we'll move on to the topic of our show today. I have two wonderful organizers here in the studio with me to discuss organizing in museums and cultural institutions. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI. We're broadcasting in NYC at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, please email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. So welcome to the studio, Megan and Antonio. If you wouldn't mind, please introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about your organizing and what brought you here today.
Sure. Hi, I'm Megan Elovato. I use she, her pronouns. I am a historian and writer and also a museum educator and teach at a university. And so I have been a long time museum and cultural worker. And so I've seen the opportunity in the recent years to really make some changes possible in terms of the issues that have been coming up.
Hi, thanks. Thanks again for having us here. My name's Antonio Serna. I'm also an artist and cultural worker, and I've been in New York for quite some time. So I've worked in private and private galleries and nonprofits and within the arts for the past 20 plus years. I only recently met with Megan because we were working on a side project researching institutions and funding and. We started to talk about how to get more workers involved in what we were doing and trying to see how we can change things from the inside as workers within the current situation that was in the past couple of years has kind of come to the forefront of museums, issues at museums.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that organizing per se. What have you done? What are you looking to do in the next maybe 6 months to a year?
So the first part of our organizing was just trying to get museum workers who within their own institutions have been making major changes, whether it's unionizing, whether it's addressing structural changes and governance in their institutions. And we said, why not try and just have a happy hour first? That's a good way to get people together and also talking to one another, so cross institutions. And so we've had three. The first one was on International Workers' Day, May 1st, 2019, mm-hmm. And we've had a three total. And from there, Antonio and I realized with this amount of information and people that we should do something even bigger.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think our first event was quite successful. We had close to 180 people involved and over 33 institutions represented. Mm-hmm. And so that was like a real first for us to see everybody come together and talking and meeting and sharing ideas and what they were doing and, you know, just having fun, you know. I was doing a lot of organizing previously around anti-gentrification and museums and also on equity. So for me, that stuff is really intense, first because it's very personal, and secondly, it's a lot of work. So the happy hour worked out fine. I loved it. And we're on the second phase where Megan mentioned that we're working on the Museum Workers Manifesto, which is kind of really, really open. It's exciting because it's really open. It's open to any worker that's working in cultural institutions and museums across New York City. And the platforms or themes are also open to the workers. So nothing is set in stone. We just have the framework for how we're doing this and we're rolling it out session per session. And they're led by different individuals from different organizations across New York City. So we're excited about that.
Right. And these sessions that we're going to be discussing in more detail, some of the themes and the theory behind this organizing, I think it's important for listeners of this show to know that they're open to the public, right? The museum community, in your vision, is expansive and includes museum visitors and other people who may not, you know, immediately identify with the label of museum or cultural worker. Is that correct?
That's
yes.
correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you are someone who doesn't like to go to museums, I think that's also an important perspective to hear about, because then that would really lead to suggesting the type of changes that institutions actually would probably be very open to.
Exactly. Right. Because if you're the type of person mm-hmm. who doesn't like going to a museum, you know, there may be, in fact, be a very good reason for that. That's something that relates to accessibility or racial justice or some other type of these exact questions that your organizing is looking to address. So let's dig into that a little bit more and let's talk about the museum space. So why organize in museums? What is the potential power of organizing in museums? And also, in what ways do we see some of these oppressive systems and hierarchies, capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, how do we see them playing out in that museum space?
Well, museums, I see them as a great potential because they are held up as these bastions of information, whether it's art, whether it's history, whether it's science, and we are brought into them as young children, mm-hmm. and it is something that we are conditioned into how to interact and think about that space. And I think that there is a lot of knowledge contained in those institutions, but if people come in with a better sense of agency, instead of thinking they have to be passive, if we can activate that space in that way, empower both the worker and the visitor beyond what is thought of as the proper way of being in museums, I think that's something that has a lot of potential.
Or in addition to Megan's perspective, I believe we're sort of in line with those ideas, but I'm also interested in how to also activate the public's understanding of how much of the city funding their tax dollars goes to these institutions,
right.
and that they actually have a say, or, you know, that these institutions are for them. So their money is already there. It's just a matter of activating how they want, what kind of spaces they want these to be, you know, in terms of, like, are they open to everyone, or, you know, from different abilities to different languages and stuff like this. So just hoping to get the public's understanding of how much budget. I mean, New York City has one of the largest budgets in the country for arts funding. I think it's at $2.12 million last I checked. So that's huge. So we want to let people know that there's a lot of their tax dollars at play there.
Well, absolutely. The economics of museums are really interesting because, as Megan sort of alluded to, they almost are perceived to be these spaces outside of the world in a certain way, that a lot of them, the classic museums, the physical design of that reinforces that feeling. You've stepped out of the busy street and you're in the sort of marble halls of learning, and it's taking kind of disrupting that image and saying, like, no, a museum is part of the world. A museum is part of the city, not only because its visitors are part of the world and part of the city, but also because there's an economic aspect of the pay of the workers, the hiring and retention practices of the museums, who are the people who are in power in museums, how is that money being used? I think in a lot of times we think of funding for the arts as this kind of universal social good, but then there's not really a lot of examination about how is that money being used? Where is it going to?
Yeah, especially when it comes to labor. I think that was a big issue a couple years ago when we were pushing for equity in the arts. Pre-civil rights, a lot of institutions had, like, specialty jobs devoted only for white American workers, and, like, the lower paid jobs or the difficult jobs were held by people of color. So it's interesting that, you know, it's 50, 60 years later and the institutions still have a percentage model in New York City, at least, that DCLA has reported, a similar model to that of, pre-civil rights age times, where 70 to 80% are mostly white workers, and people of color hold less of the fraction. And this is in a city where it's inverted, right? We have, like, close to 68% people of color making up the composition of demographics, but it's completely skewed inside the museum walls. So that's a big thing for me.
And I guess I would push you a little bit on that to say more about what is the overall impact of that type of racial disparity that we see in the museum world? How does that filter out to the experience of a museum worker or of a museum visitor?
Well, we can be an entire episode dedicated to just that, but I think that in terms of representation, and where it's very popular to say representation matters, but when you only see people in museums in service roles, whether it's janitorial or in guards, and you see that curators are white, even if it's talking about a culture that they have no experience in or not even studied in university, that it really polarizes and makes you wonder if those institutions are for you.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of, I think, obvious. There's a lot of institutions have been falling into these issues, and it's getting a lot of publicity or bad publicity when they're intending to speak for different communities and not getting it right, so to speak, and kind of from a external perspective, like subjects or objects. And so, and this is historical since the first protests at the Met Museum by the community of Harlem against an exhibition called Harlem on My Mind, which had no input from the Black community, and it kind of treated it as a kind of National Geographic like observation versus an actual lived culture that has contributions, contemporary contributions to the arts.
When was that protest?
I think 1968-69. I mean, it follows the Whitney's protest of exclusion of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1930s painting in 67 or 68. Mm-hmm. So just a complete erasure of that whole cultural production of people of color from Harlem at that time. So, I mean, it's every decade, I would say there's at least one or two bad missteps in terms of like representing individuals. And we know it's kind of easy if you include them. And if we're part of the whole discussion on how these exhibitions should roll out or these nameplates should roll out, then you'd have less of this guessing what this and that means or to a certain individual or community.
Yes, and I would say that goes back to the idea of agency and understanding where your money comes from, because any time an exhibition goes up or a new hall is named, you think, oh, that very wealthy person made this exhibition possible. Some people don't realize that their taxpayer dollars, right, all that huge chunk that's coming out of their paycheck also went to make that. And so that there are individual citizen names that could also be on there if we were thinking, like, if everyone got the credit that they deserve. But I think that if you realize that your money's going into it, then you do have the right to have a say in what that exhibition should be or what the museum should be doing.
Right. I think there's so much to be said about the economics of museums, and obviously I have a bit of a stake in that, and I think the listeners of the show have a stake in that, given that this is the DSA, the radio show. I think the public funding aspect is really interesting. Also, the private funding aspect, it's way, without getting into too many specifics, I think we can speak in broad strokes about the ways in which there's been some really alarming, what we might call art washing of money that's made from extremely ill-gotten gains that then goes back into the museum world that may then end up supporting an artist or a fellowship. But it may also not, right? It may end up supporting a high-paid white male executive, right? And so I think that once you start pulling on the threads of where the money is actually coming from, a lot of these issues start to come a lot more to the fore.
Definitely.
Yeah. And also as somebody, so I will say as well that in addition to my interest in this as a socialist and as a New York City resident, as somebody who likes art and history and culture and all that stuff, I also am a former museum worker myself. I started my, I worked at a science museum right out of high school, and I worked at a museum here in New York City as well. I worked in the gift shop. And when I worked in the gift shop, one of the roles that I was asked to do was to constantly ask for money from the public. With every ticket sale, ask for an additional donation. With every sale of a, silk scarf, ask for a $5 donation to the museum. So one thought that I often had is, why am I being asked? Why do I have to be in the position of asking everybody who's already paying $25 for an admission to this museum to donate another $5? And where is this money really going to, right? There's a lack of transparency, I think, even within the structures themselves. Great. So that's a little bit of kind of the question of, why museums, right? And now I'd love to speak a little bit about museum worker organizing here in New York and how that might be informed or inform organizing throughout the rest of the United States and perhaps even internationally. We did hear from Jean-Pierre at the top of the show. He talked about workers in the Paris Opera, the Philharmonic, participating in these general strike actions. Other countries have a lot of engagement with their cultural workers as part of a overall understanding of the working class. Is that existent in New York or not? And if not, why not? That's a small question. If you're out there and you just joined us here on Revolutions Per Minute, we are speaking with Megan and Antonio about organizing in museum and cultural spaces. So let's talk a little bit about where we are in New York and sort of what that means for your organizing.
I think New York is a place where we have potential to have many different minds working in so many different types of museums with so many different funding structures and resources that we have a wealth of knowledge that can come together to not necessarily a fully comprehensive idea of change in our institutions, but many different perspectives. And in terms of organizing in New York, I think it could create a lot of ripple effects across the country. Mm-hmm. And as someone who was born and raised in New York, I think that New York doesn't necessarily hold itself accountable to anyone else but itself. And so if things are rumbling, say, in Chicago or in Portland, New York doesn't necessarily feel like it is at a threat. But I think that if something happens in New York, the waves go outward. I like to think that things come in too, but sometimes New York is a city on a hill.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. Absolutely. I mean, we do see that there is a nationwide movement of museum workers. I've observed that just from my perspective. Would you too agree?
Definitely in terms of unionizing of workers. We see it out on the West Coast as well. Things that are happening when people move to unionize and then institutions close down. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very big response. But I feel that people and workers feel empowered and then they feel that they have support from other workers at different parts of the country.
Right. Wasn't there, if I recall correctly, there was a children's museum in California mm-hmm. that unionized with IBEW. Mm-hmm. Which is a very interesting.
San Diego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the electrical workers,
yep.
Which is really interesting. So we're also seeing some exploration of where does a museum workers union fit within the already existing labor movement. Antonio, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, I think not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. There's also the other, kind of obvious point, the top level point, which is that here in New York, we have some of best known museums in the world, right? We have the Met, we have the Museum of Natural History, but we also have a lot of smaller museums and more obscure museums. So I do think that this is one of the few places perhaps in the country where you could consider there to be sort of this like diversified museum worker industry that exists geographically here.
Yeah, we even have museums about museums, like the city of New York. Right now, it actually has an exhibition on celebrating 150 years of the CIG, the Cultural Institutions Group of New York, so mm-hmm. the funding of the first museum. So if anybody wants to go out and see that show and really learn about how that union between the city and private institutions and museums was formed, you can definitely check that exhibition out. It's happening right now.
And that's at the Museum of the City of New York?
Yes, that's correct.
They also had what I thought was quite a well-done exhibition, City of Workers, City of Struggle, back in the fall, that was about the labor history of New York City. Museums have so much power, right? When they tell those stories, they really have the power to shape them. So if you don't mind, let's dig a little bit into the nuts and bolts of organizing in museums. So there's unions, right? And we've seen there's been a lot of union activity in New York City museums over the last few years.
Yes. Yep. And so especially in 2019, it's kind of you see these dominoes of unionizing across museums. And I think that I like to think of it as a beginning of workers seeing that coming together actually make something happen, can hold their institutions accountable. But I also think that unions can be just a starting point for bigger organizing, because unions can only do so much in terms of making major structural changes within institutions. They kind of have their hands tied. And so I'd like to see the recognition of working together can really like make things move and shake around.
Yeah, I think just thinking about it right now, I feel like we've also, the reason it's one of the reasons it might be happening is just we reached a critical point where people can't survive on these wages anymore. I remember when I came here straight out of high school, I was able to hold one of these jobs for very little money, but I still had a studio and I still had an apartment and enough money for food. And I talk to museum workers now who are, some of them are artists, they don't have money for studio. Like, it's just unheard of to even have a studio. And they're just really struggling, you know, hand to mouth. And within a couple of years, I've been here for quite a while. So within a couple of years, a lot of my friends aren't here anymore. They just couldn't make it in the city. And with the increase of rent, food prices and transportation, it's really people are standing up to it. I think that's what's another factor involved.
Mm-hmm. And sort of some of the other labor issues that from my personal experience and observation, I'm aware are active in museums are kind of, you know, permanent part-timers or permalancers whose labor is being exploited in that way. Lack of upward mobility, lack of training and support. So say if you happen to be a museum educator, like we have here in the studio with us, you know, you're often asked to interact with the public around some quite serious issues, right? Museums are, there's this sort of 21st century perspective of a museum that it is a place to inspire conversation, right? But conversations can be quite loaded. And if you're putting a bunch of strangers in a room and asking them to talk about, you know, what are your feelings about the history of immigration, or what are your feelings about the history of colonialism, people coming to that conversation with different perspectives are going to interact with it a lot differently. And it takes a lot of skill as an educator to navigate those conversations. And that skill, from my observation, isn't always fairly compensated.
Yes, and I know that the museum educators within the circle that I move in often have 2-3 jobs. And so there is the reason why also we're organizing around museum workers, one of the things is that we love what we do, right? We love what we're talking about.
Right.
And just because of that, it shouldn't be taken advantage of necessarily. There is a labor of love, but also there's also living wage that is necessary. Mm-hmm. For us to keep these jobs.
Mm-hmm. A labor of love is still labor.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's true.
You can use that if you want to. One thing that we talked about as well when we were preparing for the show is that there's this, because on the topic of why New York City and what's the conditions here in this particular industry, it is also a very competitive and capitalist city. There's these jobs that are considered to be maybe coveted or prestigious, like say a curator at a major institution, the workers are encouraged to operate in a mindset of scarcity. And so I would imagine that makes building solidarity a little bit more difficult, because people are in a sort of, what's the word, like self-preservationist type of mindset.
Yeah, I think it definitely it benefits the privileged people in the city. I mean, we have the most low income earners within, you know, several blocks of the most high end of income earners. And if someone can say, I'm going to take that internship at no pay just because it's going to land me the next job, that's really a privilege. Like when I moved here, I was working since a teenager, right from Texas. And when I got here, I had 1 or 2 or 3 jobs. There was never a moment where I couldn't work for free or low pay. So it was constantly a struggle to really find those places that paid well for me, at least. So, that's definitely a problem because, there's people, yeah, that explains itself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'd love to hear, as we move into the second half of our show, I'd love to hear a little bit about this particular project that you're working on, the Museum Workers Manifesto, and sort of what the vision is for that. And folks, you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute. We are on listener-sponsored WBAI, broadcasting in New York City at 99.5 FM. The show will also be streaming on your favorite podcast app. I know that you have some upcoming sessions that the public is welcome to attend. Tell me a little bit about that Museum Workers Manifesto and what you envision coming out of it.
So the manifesto, as Antonio had mentioned, is very open. We want people to come in sharing their ideas. There is no structure provided except that we are bringing people into a room at a certain place, at a certain time. And so we have chosen five different topics. Actually, it's more than that. But starting with American Indian Community House on Thursday, mm-hmm. It's Thursday the 30th, providing an overview of the Great Law of Peace, which is the Haudenosaunee Confederacy's form of governance for millennia. And it's actually what the U.S. Constitution was based upon, but clearly got very twisted in the process. But it was about direct democracy, community accountability. And we want to we're having that as the first session because it sets a tone for thinking differently as we move forward to not unintentionally recreate the structures that we're actively trying to either deconstruct or change. Do you want to talk about your...
Oh, yeah. And so for the second session, which is the day after, it's Friday, I'm actually combining it with a project I do. It's a research project on artists of color and the history of art and activism since the 60s and how artists of color have been in or influenced by the civil rights movement in making demands to museums and desegregating museums. So for that specific session, I'm looking at the Detroit Revolutionary Workers Union Workers Movement. So the drums and all the rums out in Detroit, and looking first of all looking at how they began or what was their impetus for moving the revolutionary like civil rights movement towards working factory workers versus just what the Black Panthers were interested in, and looking then to see how they were taking the ideas of self-determination into the factories and like what their demands were. So we're going to watch a film about that, and I have a few archival materials, the newspapers that they published at the time, and I'm seeing I can pull up the Black Workers Congress Manifesto and a lot of these other archival material that they produced at that time. And then, you know, it is a stretch, but we're going to then talk about how this relates to the museum worker, and what strategies or what are the limits to comparing the two and taking those ideas into the museum from the factory.
Great. Well, the program sounds really interesting, and we will be announcing the link to the page where listeners can find out all of these details all in one place at the end of the show. And I know that part of your organizing approach, as I understand it, is quite open. It sounds as though you don't want to impose too much on these sessions before you've been through them. But could you speak a little bit about what these sessions are working toward, what you hope that the results might be coming out of these?
Yes. I guess another thing, I wonder if the people, when we said we have an open format, how wide the audience out there understood that. Just to give you another example, so I'm showing films, and the group after us is Avant-Garde, and they're going to actually be doing a performance, and they're Met workers that work at the Met as guards in the halls, the great halls of the Met. And they also do performance art, which involves their position, you know, their positions and their duties at work. And they're trying to involve people in that process. So that open platform is really kind of, I think, nice in allowing people to explore what it means for them to work at museums in whatever format. You know, we were open to poetry readings, to dinners and things like this. So it's not necessarily these workshops that you're used to. But the outcome, I mean, we've been telling the workers, you know, if we can just at the end of this try to extract a few elements of what happened and what the people and the audience in the room felt that should be in the manifesto is all we're asking. You know, it could be one or two lines, or it could be a whole page full of interesting visions for what they think they feel that museums should have in place or wish for museums. That's kind of the basis of it. Am I leaving anything out, Megan?
Yeah, the end part of each session is to have something written, but it isn't to come in writing right away. It's going through various processes to think about whether it is performance, whether it is meditation, whether it's watching film, to create a first draft. Ideally, we'd like it by May 1st of this year. And then thinking and asking people, how do we want to work with this? Because we're not going to finish everything by the end of February, but working toward the first draft for May, and then asking people, what is the next action forward?
Mm-hmm. And just to be extra super clear, so when we say Museum Workers Manifesto, it's sort of... It's the project is these workshops and happenings, to use an art world term. But there's also going to be some type of collaboratively authored document that's coming out of it, right?
Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
And what do you hope is, and just if I could ask you to speculate, right? What do you think might be some of the demands or some of the, yeah, I'll leave it there. What do you think might be some of the demands that we might see coming out of something like a Museum Workers Manifesto?
Well, we do have themes that people have shown interest in. That Megan, do you want to?
Sure. So museum governance is one of them. That's also AICH. It's not just about building community among museum workers, but then how can we think our museums can be changed administratively? I think a big exercise and point of the Museum Workers Manifesto is to be imagining beyond what already exists. Mm. I think because a lot of the times when people say museums have to change, there's a lot of pushback that says, well, how are museums going to run if like rich people don't give us money? Like there is an imagining that has to happen. And I think we just need to have people doing that and then presenting that option for those who necessarily aren't thinking that way.
Right. And what I think is really exciting about this organizing is that it's this sort of very big picture, as you say, imaginative work, but it's coming from workers and artists. It's not coming from something that's abstract or academic.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the themes are really, it's sky's the limit in some ways, I think. I think I was looking at the Black Workers Congress, and they had stuff on environmentalism, you know, not outside of the factories and stuff. So actually, that's one thing I was surprised that we didn't get a volunteer for, is the environmental issues.
Or gentrification.
But at the last, the kickoff party, I met someone who worked at a gift shop as well. And he was like, you won't believe how much garbage comes out of these gift shops. And like, it's tons and tons of garbage. So like, I'm like, hey, what do you know? Like, why don't you help organize the manifesto? And so for the fifth session, the last session, mm-hmm. is the open session. And that one is going to be several breakout groups of smaller, intimate tables of individuals who didn't necessarily want to lead a big workshop, 2-hour workshop, but they can present their ideas in different themes around the room at the same time. So there's not, you know, it's more intimate, and it works out for certain workers that way. So we're really happy that that's still open. So if people want to contribute to that, just, you know, email us and we'll talk.
And that's also something, if you can't make it out to our sessions, but want to contribute in some way, I know we're sharing our email at the end of this, is a way to just email me and Antonio. But also, if you want to stop by PS122 Gallery, who is generously hosting us, and we are part of the Art Workers Lab that is going on with this month-long events. That is also, we're also there with Cultural Workers Education Center. So it is very labor-focused, but you can just stop by the gallery on the open days, and we'll have a Dropbox where you can just like write any ideas that you want to contribute to us. So it is different ways of sharing with us if you can't physically be there for the sessions.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's going to be kind of like a worker center, but like informal, you know, there's nobody going to be filing grievances or like taking down detailed information, but we can help point you to resources or other people in the industry who are working on certain things, like unionizing art handlers, or there's a lot of people who are interested in art education who want to kind of mobilize and organize, because a lot of the art schools in the city are just horror stories, I believe. So we're trying to help build those, to bring those people together in that space. And again, we're really thankful that PS 122 is coming back and allowing us to have this platform for the next 30 days, I think. Yeah. So it's going to be really cool.
Yeah. And this is, and to be speaking to you right at the beginning of this organizing, I think is really cool. And maybe you should come back and give us an update right after you. After you've been through the sessions.
Right,
yeah,
definitely.
Happy to.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so it's the time of our show when we open the phones to those who are out there listening who would like to join the conversation. So the number here is 212-209-2877. Once again, that's 212-209-2877. And the question is, we've been sitting here for 30 minutes talking about museums. Has anything that we've said changed the way that you think about museums? Has anything that you've heard today been surprising or new? That is the question. You can give us a call. The number is 212-209-2877. And if you don't call, you're just going to hear more of us. So, well, one thing that's kind of on my mind that hasn't yet been in this conversation is, and that's close to my heart personally, both politically and from my own experience, is gender and patriarchy in museums. I have my own thoughts about it, but I'm wondering if, just throwing out that large topic, if you have anything that you'd like to say.
Anything you want to lead us with, or
sure? Well, right. Well, I've got a lot. I've got a lot to get off my chest because you know this is. I live this, right? Like I've worked in several museums: science museum, children's museum, history museum, right? So I've seen it from a variety of angles, and I was always at the front desk or in the shop. And always, when you work in the front desk or the shop, you're going to be working with women. Right? It was women and queer men. It's highly, highly feminized labor. And that also tends to be the aspect of the museum, one of the aspects of museum, worker life that's, undervalued. There's generally not a path upward, path of mobility. You're kind of looking over at the folks who are doing more direct public facing, education. And you're not getting the same type of prestige or recognition that those people are. They're probably underpaid as well. But that's one of the major, in my experience, sort of divisions that's hard to get over within museums is the customer service versus, right, I even just heard myself going there, versus education or versus curatorial or whatever it might be. And in my observation, one of those sectors does tend to be highly feminized.
Mm. In the museum world, you can see the idea of pink collar jobs. And it plays into not only gender, but also class roles of who should be the front facing, right? Who makes the decisions? And you see that parallel too. But I also see that it can bring, not necessarily infighting, but that if a woman has made her way up the ladder by herself, made it through when she was part, she had to break through the boys' club. Mm-hmm. She also doesn't necessarily feel that she should bring the next generation of women up with her, that it should be the same. So I think, yeah, there's a whole lot. I mean, as a former museum worker, if you want to host a session on the 16th to talk about that, because that's not necessarily something that we have covered yet in the manifesto, and talking about the gendered part of the museum.
The gendered aspects of it. And I think, you know, if you were to grab somebody on the street and ask them, hey, what do you think about, let's say activism, because that's a word that people recognize maybe more so than organizing. Activism plus museum, what might you say? A lot of people don't have much to say about it, right? I think, you know, you could call in and say something about it right now if you wanted to. But this is an aspect of social justice that's lesser known unless you've had direct experience with it in some way. But one thing that people might know is they might know something like the Guerrilla Girls, mm-hmm. right? Or they might know something like Judy Chicago mm-hmm. that is organizing around, you know, representation of women in art that is still, you know, it's still a live issue, right? So not to even like, and then when you start getting into like women of color, right, then that's an even more sort of marginalized space, both for artists and for workers. So, that's just kind of my, if I were to participate in one of those sessions, that would be something I would be interested in discussing.
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, my entry point to that is just through the writings of Bell Hooks and when mm-hmm. she talked about the whole lean in manifesto, the women's manifesto for mm-hmm. leaning into the white patriarchy. Yeah. And from an intersectional perspective, I think that's a good, if people want to read that review, Bell Hooks, it's quite for themselves. I recommend it.
Oh, wait, it's a Bell Hooks review of Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I can't believe I've never heard of that. That sounds very juicy.
And also, I think that leads into where if it is seeing many women working in museums and then not having a living wage, that there, even if there is mobility within the institution, if you want to have a family, how do you support that family? And you want to be also a caretaker as well. It doesn't really offer you that opportunity. And it means that there is going to be a stagnation, that people can only reach a certain level. And that leaves those who are either financially able to or have the connections to be in the more powerful positions in an institution. So there's all these little aspects that overlap mm-hmm. in terms of perpetuating the institutions as they are today.
Right. And I think that to me underscores one of the major, what I would say is maybe a major overarching theme of conversations like this, which is that working in a museum is work, right? And it comes with a lot. It comes with the issues that being a worker and being a member of the working class does. It's not removed from the problems of society because it happens to be, say, in a beautiful institutionalized building. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're nodding. I'll narrate it for the radio listening public. Well, great. So, thank you, to both of you, for being here and how nice that we could also get a live update from Jean-Pierre and from Jack. In the last, minutes of the show, tell the folks, how they can learn more about everything that we've spoken about and how they can learn, where and when to visit these sessions.
So the most direct way to find out about the sessions and to RSVP is either go directly to our website, which is tinyurl.com/museumworkersmanifesto, or find us on Facebook or also on Instagram, which is NYC Museum Workers HH. And we've been posting all the information about the sessions on Instagram, Facebook, and questions. If you want to email us with questions, it's nycmuseumworkershh@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Can you say the website again? Just
sure. tinyurl.com/museumworkersmanifesto.
Right. And I've been to that link myself, and I can attest that it really has everything that you might want to know about the project. So I encourage everyone listening to Revolutions Per Minute tonight to take a look and take a look at the sessions. You may be surprised. Again, I think that part of this work, as I see it, is expanding the vision of who this matters to and who this is important to. Obviously, it's important to people who are working in museums, but people who are visiting museums, maybe sending their kids on field trips, maybe running field trips themselves. We have a lot of teachers in our socialist movement, right? And they're taking kids on field trips to museums. I think that's an interesting crossover. We have a couple of minutes left in the show before we say goodbye today. So I'd love to throw you each a curveball and ask you, you know, what is a museum out there that you think is doing really good work, whether that's in New York City or nationally or internationally?
And what price range are we talking about?
What do you mean by price range?
The like free ones? Or, you know, because I look at museums, I look at, I categorize the free ones, the ones that are over $20 per entry, because I can't necessarily go to those quite frequently. So it's actually, I mean, with the rise in cost of museums, I can't go as frequently as I used to go. Obviously working more now, so there's less of those free times that you want to just spend with your family or friends. And you really think twice about like hitting all the museums uptown in one day, because that run you about $75 to $100.
Right.
So that's that, but that wasn't the answer.
Yeah. So is there a museum that's free that you think is doing really good work? I'm intrigued that that was where your mind went to first.
Well, I'm kind of, I don't want to sound pessimistic. Some of my research is really into that, like I mentioned, people of color and that history. And I've seen museums starting to do that just now, but they're still leaving out some important aspects of that history. And maybe it's, yeah, I'm not sure why, but they're still a kind of, it's not really getting to, for me as a museum goer, where I need to go. For example, there was a poster for the farm workers, but it wasn't done from the farm worker art groups. It was done from, you know, from another perspective. So I'm really looking for museums telling that story still.
Yeah. Megan, do you have anything that you'd like to say quickly?
Sure. I didn't expect to say this, but I think that some of the Smithsonian museums are doing or are working towards trying to get visitor input. The Museum of American History actually put out their What Do You Want to Hear and See in our halls. And I think that the Museum of African American History and Culture is incredibly, not incredibly, but extremely well done in having parallel timelines that talk about European history and African history side by side that really fill in the gaps that are left out of so many of our history textbooks.
I've heard really good things about that one, and I'd love to visit. Well, thank you both so much for coming and speaking about your organizing.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, please keep in touch and let us know how it's been going. Thanks for listening to Revolutions Per Minute. I'm Amy Wilson. We'll be back on listener-sponsored WBAI next Tuesday at 5 p.m. And we'll see you in the streets.